It's interesting, you know, that we're talking about the first great awakening of the 18th century, revival, when the church was so languishing, so dead, comatose, hardly any Christians, churches not multiplying but dwindling. And this tremendous revival of the 18th century that we're talking about, and it will interest you to know that of the colonial colleges in America, of which there were nine, six of them came out of the Great Awakening, the revival that we're talking about. And before we're through, not tonight, but before we're through with this one, I'll have something to say about the foundation of those. Now, we got last Sunday as far as the conversion and the open-air preaching of George Whitefield. You remember that we painted a picture of the conditions in England and the conditions in the United States, then America, and they were very poor. But God began to work. He began to work in New England through Jonathan Edwards in Northampton, Massachusetts, and a revival in that church, a church just like this, but beginning to see great revival. And then he began to work in England by saving key people whom he was going to use, and particularly during the year of 1735. And they were all unknown to one another, and in different places, God began to work in them and separate them out and call them to the ministry of the gospel. A couple of them were in Oxford University. One was an Oxford tutor, a don, called John Wesley, and his brother Charles. Another one was a student at Oxford, but a very poor student, working his way through college by serving the other students. His name was George Whitefield, born in an inn, and he came from a very poor family. He was to be perhaps the most powerful preacher ever since the Apostle Paul. And then there were others. George Whitefield, I was going to say, was the first to take the gospel outdoors into the open air. But of course, as I told you last week, he was really following the example of somebody he'd heard about, a Mr. Morgan, whom we know nothing more of than that. He braved the open air preaching first, led the way, and then George Whitefield went to the Kingswood Miners. Do you recall? Nobody cared for them. They were just an unruly mob, living almost like animals. No church, no gospel, no shepherd, nobody cared. And George Whitefield, with all his Anglican robes and his wig, went out and preached the gospel to them. And thousands began to throng to hear him every Wednesday, every Saturday, and every Sunday. Do you remember I told you how that as they heard of one who loved them and died for them, and that their sins could be forgiven, the tears from their eyes made white rivulets through the coal dust on their faces. He wrote to John Wesley and said, "Come, come, the fire is kindled in the country, shall never be put out." And it was a time of great revival. And others went on preaching that gospel, the length and breadth of the British Isles, whilst George Whitefield returned to the United States. And he landed at Lewis, Delaware on October 30th in 1739. Now, I want to encourage you to be readers. I know that I'm going to look back on my pastorate here and think of all the things I've failed in. And one of them is I have not really given attention to the library and to bookstalls and to encouraging you to read. And it's one of the sad things that we have today, even sometimes amongst college students, that reading of Christian books is negligible, and sometimes where it's at all, they're rather superficial. I'm going to recommend you to read two volumes on George Whitefield by Arnold Allimore. Good bedtime stuff, this. You know, The Life and Times of the Great Evangelist of the 18th Century Revival. Arnold Allimore's two volumes on George Whitefield. I'm going to read some bits to you, some tonight and some next Sunday night, so you'll know not to come if you don't like it. Page 431, let me find it. Following the journey across the Atlantic on the boat, Dalymore says about Whitefield, "Happy to be released from the confinement of life aboard, Whitfield left the vessel as soon as it reached America. This was at Lewistown in Delaware. Yet even here he found he was known and requested by the mayor, quote, to give them a sermon, unquote. After complying, he set out to hasten to reach Philadelphia by land while the family continued the journey by water. And such was his delight in being active again that he rode as 50 and 60 miles a day. Whitfield found Philadelphia a city of brotherly love in the reception that it accorded him, and after arriving on a Friday night, November 2nd, 1739, he, quote, read prayers. This is when I say quote, it's from his journals. Everybody kept journals in those days. He read prayers and assisted at the Church of England on Sunday, made the acquaintance of the Presbyterian and Baptist ministers on Monday, preached in the Church of England on Tuesday, dined with Thomas Penn, the Quaker, on Wednesday. That was the son of William Penn. By the way, there's a footnote in Dalamore to tell us that Thomas and William, Thomas and Richard, the sons of William Penn, were possessors of a feudal estate of 25 million acres. Just imagine that. It's more than I have. Thomas Penn, the Quaker, on Wednesday. By that time, however, the inhabitants were very solicitous for him to preach in another place besides the church. And so, in response, on Thursday evening, he held his first open-air service. Though it was late autumn and the days were getting cold, he, quote, preached from the courthouse stairs to about 6,000 people. Therewith, Philadelphia's courthouse square became, like London's Kennington, his sky-domed cathedral. On Friday, Saturday and Sunday, it was filled with hearers, about 8,000 each time. And of the Friday meeting, he reported, now this is Whitfield himself, before I came, all was hushed and exceedingly quiet. The night was clear but not cold. Lights were in most of the windows all around us for a considerable distance. The people did not seem weary of standing, nor was I weary of speaking. The Lord endued me with power from on high. My heart was enlarged and warmed with divine love, and my soul was so carried out in prayer that I thought I could have continued my discourse all night. So he often went to Philadelphia and he preached, as we have said. He went up to New York and preached in New York, and there's some very interesting accounts of that. But I want to read to you from Benjamin Franklin, because Ben Franklin gives an account of a Whitfield preaching in Philadelphia. By the way, the two became friends, although we never have any record that Benjamin Franklin was ever actually converted. This is Franklin. In 1739, there arrived among us the Reverend Mr. Whitfield. He was at first permitted to preach in some of the churches, but the clergy, taking a dislike to him, soon refused him their pulpits, and he was obliged to preach in the fields. The multitudes of all sects and denominations that attended his sermons were enormous, and it was a matter of speculation with me, who was one of their number, to observe the extraordinary influence of his oratory on his hearers, and how much they admired and respected him, notwithstanding his common abuse of them, by assuring them that they were naturally half beasts and half devils. It was wonderful to see the change soon made in the manners of our inhabitants, for from being thoughtless or indifferent about religion, it seemed as if all the world were growing religious, so that one could not walk through Philadelphia in an evening without hearing psalms sung in different families of every street. Isn't that wonderful? He had a loud, clear voice. By the way, he was only in his very early 20s, you know, Whitfield, when he came. He articulated his words with sentences so perfectly that he might be heard and understood at a great distance, especially as his audiences, however numerous, observed the most exact silence. He preached one evening from the top of the courthouse steps, which are in the middle of Market Street, and on the west side of Second Street, which crosses it at right angles. Both streets were filled with his hearers to a considerable distance. Being among the hindmost in Market Street, I had the curiosity to learn how far he could be heard. By retiring backwards down the street towards the river, I found his voice distinct till I came near Front Street, when some noise in that street obscured it. Imagining then a semicircle, of which my distance should be the radius, and that it were filled with auditors, to each of whom I allowed 2 square feet, I computed that he might well be heard by more than 30,000. This reconciled me to the newspaper accounts of his having preached to 25,000 people in the fields. So it doesn't sound as if Benjamin Franklin was taking an awful lot of notice of what Whitfield said, but he was at least working out whether it really could be true that a man without any voice assistance, of course, could be heard by 25,000 people in the open air standing listening. And he worked out he surely could be. In places in England, particularly around London, Moorfields, Mayfair, Hampstead Heath, Kennington, crowds of the same kind of numbers gathered to listen to George Whitfield and to John Wesley. Well, then, George Whitfield travelled overland to Savannah. And that was very rarely done in those days, because it was pretty tough going through the trails and through the forests and so on, all the way to Savannah, Georgia. Mostly people would go by sea, but he wanted to go by land. And that's what brought him to Wilmington. It's rather interesting to read about that. During the first 100 miles of travelling, the territory was fairly well populated, and Whitfield was able to preach to some large crowds. His journal reports, "Chester, Thursday, November 29th. I preached to about 5,000 people from a balcony. It being court day, the justices sent word that they would defer their meeting till mine was over. Wilmington, Friday, November 30th. Preached at noon and again at 3 in the afternoon. Received several fresh invitations to preach at various places, was obliged to refuse them all. Oh, that I had 100 tongues and lives, that they should all be employed for my dear Lord Jesus." Does that comment remind you of one of Charles Wesley's hymns? Oh, for what? Oh, for 1,000 tongues. And of course, Charles Wesley was a great songster of the revival and a great friend of George Whitfield. Newcastle, Saturday, December 1st. Preached to about 2,000 from a balcony, but did not speak with so much freedom and power as usual. God being pleased to humble my soul by inward visitations and a bodily indisposition, lay on the bed after the sermon, which much refreshed me. White Clay Creek, Sunday, December 2nd. The weather was rainy, but upwards of 10,000 people were assembled. White Clay Creek. June and I went on a pilgrimage one day on our day off to try and find the place, and we did, to find the place more or less where the crowd assembled to listen to George Whitfield, near the Presbyterian Church there. There were several hundreds of them. It surprised me to see such a number of horses. There were several hundreds of them. I preached from a tent erected for me by Mr. William Tennant. I continued my discourse for an hour and a half, after which we went into a log house nearby, took a morsel of bread, warmed ourselves. I preached a second time from the same place, but my body was weak. Franklin published an account of these meetings in his newspaper, and his figures on the average are higher than those of Whitfield. See, sometimes people have criticized Whitfield and Wesley for their numbers and saying that maybe they exaggerated. But Benjamin Franklin was a very careful scientist, and if anything, his computations were higher. Moreover, his report of the Sunday gathering says that 3,000 came on horseback. And one cannot but wonder what commotion must have been caused, says Dalymore, by the assembling, tethering, feeding, and watering of so many animals. So Whitfield moved on southward, preaching at northeast in Maryland, Annapolis, and on down through to Savannah. And then in 1740, he began a spring tour again up in the middle colonies and the north. And this time he came north by sea, landing at Newcastle, Delaware, 479 page in in this book, so let me see if I can find it. It was on the Monday of Sunday, April 13th, 1740, that Whitfield's sloop cast anchor at Newcastle, Delaware. He came ashore mentally burdened and physically weak, and he arrived both unannounced and unexpected. Yet this was the beginning of his spring evangelistic tour. The lack of advance notice, however, proved to be in no way a hindrance. He preached at the morning service of the Church of England, but news of his arrival spread so rapidly that a large crowd assembled for an afternoon meeting. While this service was in progress, Charles Tennant and some 200 of his people came galloping into the churchyard. The report of Whitfield's presence had caused Tennant to cancel his own service at White Clay Creek, and the post-haste ride brought him and his congregation to Newcastle in time to hear the sermon. The news, "Whitfield is back," rang with joyous excitement through the area, and people began to invite him several ways to come and preach to them. But he hastened to reach Philadelphia and the congregation of 3,000 that assembled at Wilmington. His one pause to preach on the way gave evidence that the people were ready to attend. So we get another mention, 3,000 at Wilmington. One of the things that George Whitfield was concerned about was the social conditions of people, as well as the salvation of their souls, and particularly orphans. Of course, mortality rate was high, people often didn't live very long, there were a lot of orphans, children left, both parents having died. So he wanted to begin an orphanage in Georgia. And it was a tough undertaking, and it was going to cost a lot of money. And so one of the things he did when he preached around was to take up collections for his orphanage. Some historians have said the orphanage was an albatross around his neck, because he never could get enough money to get it finished, or although he did get it finished, and to run it, and it was always giving him problems. But anyway, he persisted. And Benjamin Franklin has something interesting about his pleading for the orphanage. Benjamin Franklin. "Mr. Whitfield preached up this charity and made large collections, for his eloquence had a wonderful power over the hearts and purses of his hearers, of which I myself was an instance. I did not disapprove of the design, but as Georgia was then destitute of materials and workmen, and it was proposed to send them from Philadelphia at great expense, I thought it would have been better to have built the house here and brought the children to it. This I advised, but he was resolute in his first project, rejected my counsel, and I therefore refused to contribute. I happened soon after to attend one of his sermons, in the course of which I perceived he intended to finish with a collection, and I silently resolved he should get nothing from me. I had in my pocket a handful of copper, 3 or 4 silver dollars, and 5 pistoles in gold. As he proceeded, I began to soften, and concluded to give the coppers. Another stroke of his oratory made me ashamed of that, and I determined to give the silver. And he finished so admirably that I emptied my pocket wholly into the collector's dish, gold and all. At this sermon there was also one of our club, who, being of my sentiments respecting the building in Georgia, and suspecting a collection might be intended, had, by precaution, emptied his pockets before he came from home. Towards the conclusion of the discourse, however, he felt a strong desire to give, and applied to a neighbour who stood near him to borrow some money for the purpose. The application was unfortunately made to perhaps the only man in the company who had the firmness not to be affected by the preacher. His answer was, 'At any other time, friend Hopkinson, I would lend to thee freely, but not now, for thou seemest to be out of thy right senses.'" I think we're going to leave it there for tonight, and next week we'll go on with Whitfield into New England, and a lovely meeting between himself and Jonathan Edwards, as they began to realize that that this was not an isolated work, but was a new work of God that was going on both sides of the Atlantic, and was perhaps the mightiest thing that God had done, other than the great Reformation of the 16th century under Martin Luther and John Calvin and others, since the Acts of the Apostles. You know, we should always have an interest in history, but particularly the history of God's people. It gives us a link with the past, but it excites us for what God can do in the present and may do in the future.